FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today's May 9th, 2017. Well, is the housing bubble bursting to our friends north of the border? There's been a lot of recent activity that tends to say yes, but the problem is when you're in a bubble, it's hard to recognize that you're in a bubble, as our erstwhile former Fed chairman Alan Greenspan used to tell us. We weren't in a bubble until the bubble didn't exist anymore. But Danielle Park is with us. Danielle, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, Kerry.
So, bubble bursting, or is it just going to keep going on with different players? I mean, you had a major housing financial lender blow up recently. What a shock. And is it the tip of the iceberg, or do they paper it over and move forward?
Well, I don't know if that particular event is a tipping point. I think that all of these things tend to weigh around the perimeter of a bubble. And I would take issue with, of course, what Mr. Greenspan said. I would say it differently. I would say that asset bubbles are quite evident in terms of the insanity of valuations and behaviors and speculative fervor that goes on. I think it's quite easy to tell when things are looking frothy around you in real time. That's if you're not a central banker or an economist who are paid to continually, forecast perpetually smooth growth and low inflation. That's kind of their job description. They're supposed to keep everyone calm and believing. But for the rest of us who live in the real world, it's easy for us to tell when things are looking destructive and speculative and dangerous. What's very difficult to know, though, impossible really, is when the actual peak or tipping point happens. So all we do is really try and gauge the valuations all the time on various assets. And then we look at things like the fund flows. And then we look at things like speculation and fervor or appetite amongst the people who are directing capital. And certainly we would say that it's been looking pretty sketchy in Canada, but in particular in the last year, since the Vancouver market really peaked in terms of sales in about July of 2016, we've seen quite a few things start to roll over, tangentially related to housing and real estate in North America since last July. And I think that there's just buyer exhaustion, there's record debt levels, there's demographics which are totally against this continued trend in everyone wanting a single family dwelling. That's really not sustained by the demographics here. And, we've got that on top of the retail collapse, which I know you're aware of. Oh, yeah. And U.S. REITs, for example, all peaked the share prices in about July of 16, and many are down 30 and 60% since then. So, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that we're probably, we're certainly seeing falling sales now in the hot areas in Canada. And falling sales generally is a precursor to price. It can happen sometimes with as much as 8 months to a year of lag before price starts to soften. But certainly in my area and north of Toronto, the supply has surged incredibly. There's something like 60% surge in supply this spring over last of new listings. And in the nicer areas, the more expensive areas, you're seeing, every third house going up for sale this spring. So I think a lot of people are thinking, hey, go while the going's good.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, when too many people head for the exit at the same time, then you have a potential for a crash, major crash. I mean, we've seen it. It's not like this has never happened before, Danielle. We see it over and over and over again throughout history and throughout markets, right? As long as the number of buyers exceeds the number of sellers, then prices can go up or at least stay the same. But once that reverses, then the fun begins.
Well, and the math is so unsustainable because certainly in Canada, we really haven't had a good old-fashioned, wipeout in real estate since the late 80s, early 90s. And it took about a decade after the 1990, in the recession that hit and the decline in housing. And it took at least into 2002, really, before prices started to firm after Greenspan cut rates to 1%. The Canadian Central Bank followed suit in that recession of 01, 02. then we sort of saw, you know, rates began to drive a marginal new category of buyers. And that was out of 03. And we've really had a run since then in terms of above average, above historical norm gains in many areas in Canada. But again, as I say, it's really been the last year and a half where we just saw, you know, nut job frenzy, like people, you know, bidding wars and going for, you know, well over the asking price, and, you know, just the debt ratios that people have taken on. There's many mortgages are, you know, 450% of disposable income, and just stuff that in a normal, sober, reflective environment, people would say, well, that's destructive. Don't take on that much debt. You can't afford to pay that much for housing because then you won't have enough left over to eat. Never mind save, never mind maintain the property, never mind, you know, anything else that you need to do in real life. So yeah, it's been, I think there's about 5 or 6% of our population who, just like in your boom into 2005, when your housing ownership ratio went to almost 70%, it was like 69% or something from a long-term norm of about 64.5. We're there now. Our household ownership is about 70%. And historically, that's mean reverted in every country in the developed world back to that 64-65. So at the margin, it's those people who have been able to get on the property ladder the last few years only because of lax lending, only because of you know, ability, access, and appetite for ludicrous levels of debt.
Yeah, well, the debt will always do you in the long run, and it does. It's reminiscent of the type of real estate booms we have in the great state of California, where the market just takes off, and then there's a panic where people, you feel like you're going to miss out, so you've got to join the whole herd. And then at some point it reverses and the carnage is what's left over. So I guess.
Yeah. And it's, you know, now it's like the real estate, it's like the retail sector, the zombie, you know, companies that have been kept going and over incented to overproduce. And, you know, it's the China bubble of the last 15 years rolled into the world's largest consumer debt bubble ever in history. You know, all that capacity has really flooded the world in excess goods and supplies. And then as that trickles back onto, you see excess stores, commercial retail space everywhere. That's all now starting to consolidate. That's code word for some going bankrupt and others, you know, repurposing and scaling down. So you're really being left with this exodus of buyers, of capital, of write downs in values. You know, and a lot of, like, one anecdote that I thought was hilarious or really reflective of what we're dealing with here is, you know, retail companies or mall owners who are saying to investors, you know, don't panic. All the empty stores that we're having with the empty parking lots, we're now renting that out to car dealers who have too much inventory to park cars. And I thought, well, precisely, you see, this is how long can that go on? You know, what kind of a business model is that? That you've got all these highly levered now dealers with too much real estate, too much cars. Because once, you know, again, we think we've seen peak sales in auto already as well, too. That's rolled over. And, you know, it's everything going down at the same time. And poor old Canada, you know, really can't catch a break these days because we just didn't plan. We knew the demographic bubble was shifting toward, you know, people wanting to downsize. We've now officially got more people over 65 than under 15 in Canada.
Really?
You know, by 2023, we're going to be as old as Japan, believe it or not, in terms of ratios. And we just know that older people want less things. They want less property to upkeep. They want, especially in a low yield environment, they want less expenses. And we've got this abundant oversupply of not only, you know, single family dwellings, but outrageously priced single family dwellings, where the average price across the country is well over $500,000 a property. And in major cities, it's well over $800,000, a couple of million dollars. Like, it's just lunatic. So I think, you know, we're getting what we deserve, unfortunately, but it isn't going to make it easier for many Canadians who just are totally unprepared for this. You know, they've got, they're trying to retire again. Many people who were trying to retire in 08 and then paused because their securities portfolios took such a major downturn are now, you know, 8 years later, planning to retire again. They're that much older. Their assets have recovered to a large degree, but here we are at peak cycle again. So, you know, it makes me just cringe. I feel so bad that the oblivious are not aware that they now face the same kind of price risk. And they didn't change their asset allocation. If anything, they're more concentrated in consumer debt, in real estate, you know, in oil, because our stock market in Canada, for example, is 70% almost just energy and financials. Yeah. And then, you know, add in the REITs and all the mutual funds that people are holding are obscenely, you know, exposed and concentrated in those vulnerable sectors. So we really have to reinvent ourselves up here. And, mm-hmm. you know, as you know, Carrie, we're a beautiful country. We have great people. We have, you know, it's stunning geography. But we really have to get smart about how we recalibrate this thing, because the old selling rocks and trees to everybody on debt is just run its course, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Speaking of trees, we have the prospect of a trade war between Canada and the U.S. You know, it seems to have been triggered something to do with dairy prices. I don't quite understand it. It's not like, yeah. I don't follow the dairy sector. I mean, ever since China created collateralized bovine obligations, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, you've got farmland and everything else has been going up like crazy. But it appears, I don't know if trade war is the right thing. I can't see the U.S. and Canada really getting into a serious trade war, but there's certainly some conflict going on. Shall we say that?
There certainly is. Well, you know, typically, this is another sort of black mark for us right now, because typically when an economic slowdown comes, when peak cycle passes, one of the countervailing forces for Canada is typically that our currency weakens. As you know, the loonie was very strong in the commodities boom into 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011. It rebounded a bit. And then it's been in a very sustained down cycle since. It's about 73 cents US today. You know, we think that it's quite likely we could see the Canadian dollar back in the 60s, even the mid 60s really? Range against the US dollar in the months ahead. And normally that would be a help. You know, once our currency weakens significantly, we become more attractive to our largest trading partner, you in the US. But with the sentiment in Washington currently being very sort of protectionist, let's say, and buy America and that sort of thing, which I understand why that's the theme. The whole world is retrenching and trying to, you know, supply in-house where possible to lower their expenditures, lower their what they have to import from other countries. So sure. We're sort of caught up in that that perfect storm right now of the U.S. wanting to be more buy at home. However, we are each other's largest trading partners, as I think you know. So I think there's incentive here for, you know, to find some kind of middle ground. But I've no doubt that certain sectors, like probably dairy and lumber, are going to have, at least in the near term, a further complication or headwind because of all this rhetoric.
Yeah. So is it Justin Trudeau trying to be macho and take on Trump, or is there really something underlying this fundamental that maybe I'm not seeing in others?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's about the politicians. I think that the forces that are shaping the world today are not to do with the figureheads. They are to do with the global imbalances, the lack of sufficient income to pay one's expenses while servicing record levels of debt. And that's everywhere in the world. So, you know, I think we would have had these issues come up no matter who had held leadership of either country at this juncture. And it's going to be a ongoing theme, frankly, because as we know, they're not going to clear the indebtedness and the demographic weight that's weighing on the world right now is not going to be fixed quickly. It's not going to be fixed overnight, not going to be fixed with the stroke of anyone's pen or executive orders of any kind. It's going to be a sort of a grind down with, you know, disappointing numbers. The answer lies in lower asset prices so that yields are higher, so that affordability comes way in. You know, we were talking just before the show about your finding, is it Blue Label?
The Blue Apron, that was.
Blue Apron, sorry.
BlueApron.com/survival.
Yes. So this is part of survival in this new environment. We've seen, you know, in the credit bubble, there was a proliferation of how of eating out places, right? Restaurants, chains, you know, big food everywhere, all pretty bad for you, pretty bad for the environment, pretty unhealthy. But when people had access to credit, they got lazier and lazier, and they just stopped learning how to make food. And it's had a negative effect on health, but it's also bad because the kids in the families are not learning how to prepare food. And what I think is one of the really good things that comes out of this kind of a wipeout phase where everyone realizes that credit is a destructive drug is they go back to trying to be more frugal and efficient with what they're doing. And part of that is learning to cook, frankly. So I know there's several services up here, and a lot of my friends have discovered them, where they bring these, you know, fresh ingredients, is delivered to your door at quite a cost effective, you know, relative to going out to restaurants. I think there's a few knockoff effects there. One is that it gives people the ingredients fine, sort of baby steps, gets them enticed to just put this stuff together. But it also shows them, hey, it's actually very easy to make delicious fish or delicious, you know, whatever it is you're making. All I need is, you know, a lot of people just keep the recipe and, hey, I could just go get these goods myself in bulk and, you know, make it the next time. So it really does teach them. And it really does show kids that food can be made in-house. And I really do think that's part of the solution, is going back to more self-sufficiency and being more careful with what we're consuming, both food and goods, and where, you know, where we're recycling our dollars. And I think when I always say, you know, cash flows have always been cyclical. They always will be. In boom times, there's tons of money and people get wasteful and do less intelligent things typically. In more frugal times, there's a crunch on. And that's when people start really looking at numbers, looking at consumption patterns, and looking at things they can do to downsize. And the whole world is right now focusing on that very theme.
Yeah, that's a great point. And hey, without Blue Apron, I would never know how to make a crispy browned shallot, you know? Just never even dreamed or dawned on me that shallots were like a good ingredient for flavoring. And now, if
you want to look for a shallot and you were in a grocery store, you would know what to look for, right? So you next time you'd be like, hey, I can grab a couple of those shallots and a couple of this and a couple of that. You know, I love cooking. It's actually one of my main hobbies, and vegan cooking in particular, I really love. But I don't think there's anything more productive a human can do than make delicious, healthy food for your family. Honestly, it's fun. It's rewarding. It's completely, you know, what do you call it? Short-term gratification, but in a very healthy way. So, you know, I think it's part of the right things that are going to happen here.
Hey, and for a family, you know, families that have dinner together around the table, you know, the majority of the time, kids are much less likely to get into trouble. The family's more engaged, and it's a nice project. Like when my kids are here and we cook a Thanksgiving dinner or whatever, it really is a great bonding experience as well, which is all part of the ad that that I've done for Blue Apron. But it's really a highly enjoyable and productive time that the family can spend together. And like you said, we've kind of gotten away from that. The luxury of just going out to eat whenever you feel like it kind of has eclipsed that for many families.
You get to a point where when you make good food at home, you actually don't want to go out very often, because the food you get when you're in a restaurant is substandard to what you're able to prepare fresh for a fraction of the cost and with much less salt and additives and things that are bad for you. So, you know, I'm literally at the point where we don't go out very much because we love to be in our home and to make our own food.
That's a great thing. Yeah, well, hey, I think it's a whole return to basics in society. It happens gradually at first, then it happens rapidly. It's cyclical. And the symbol of affluent society of having like way over stored in retail and restaurants, I think that will also be reverting to mean shortly. And you want to find out more, go over to Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com. Got our weekly commentary there. Check out our site, Financial Survival Network. Questions, comments, email me, kl@carrielutz.com. The Twitter feed is @CarrieLutz, and the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network, where we try to find very absurd stories that just illustrate the points that Danielle and I were discussing. Danielle, we will talk to you in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.